Nice to see your smiling faces. So, let's begin as we have with some meditation. So, you know, it's very good if you do something in your own meditation room, always to begin with something to calm the mind. You know, the ordinary thoughts that are going through it and possibly ordinary motivations that might not be pure dharma, maybe mixed with worldly dharmas. And then you can instill within that mind that's been calmed a little bit positive motivation for your session, whatever you're going to do, if you're going to be making offerings or doing puja or some sadhana or something like that. So we'll begin again by, we'll go sequentially from an object that's easy to find, concentrating on it, the breathing. And by breathing I mean recognizing when you're breathing out in and when it's changing direction, when you're breathing out. That's that object of observation is really relatively easy to acquire because it's there, it's you know, present to your mind. Looking at the nature of the mind is much more subtle. And I'd mentioned before, I don't know if anyone had noticed, when you do the breathing meditation, I asked you to try to note the subtlety or grossness of the breathing. You know, just get a feeling how whether that was very, very subtle or medium. And then I asked also to compare that with the subtlety or grossness of the breathing when you're meditating on the nature of the mind. Did anyone remember that? No one tried? Okay, maybe try this time. See if, you know, after watching the breathing for some time, just try to remember what that breathing is like. Is it very, very subtle or normal or gross? And then when we meditate on the subtler object of the consciousness, also at some points, check what the breathing is like. Although you're not focusing on the breathing, just take your attention away from the mind for a second, watch the breathing. Compare that to the breathing when you were using it as your object of concentration. Okay, so let's begin. Relax your body. Relax your mind. You don't have to think of anything else. And without controlling the breathing, just watch it, observe it. But with that added factor of wisdom, recognizing when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out. if you have any trouble in the sense of still feeling like you're controlling the breathing, or you can't avoid it, you know, you take a big breath and then you have to breathe out and you seem to be controlling it, try this. Think, this breath I'm watching happened before, earlier. And so I'm just remembering it. So, you know, something that happened before, you can't control any longer. If you look at it from that perspective, there's more chance of being able to just observe it rather than have the feeling that you're controlling it or that you need to control it. So here the main method for letting go of the interfering thoughts is just to tighten your attention on the breathing. Try to watch it, you know, in its entirety. In inhalation, the change from breathing in to breathing out, that endpoint. Watch the exhalation, the change as it ends and begins to just turn into an inhalation. the mind begins to calm a little bit, follow one respiration up your nostrils as though it goes to the crown of your head, to your throat, to the middle of your chest, left, in terms of being left and right, near the back, near the spine. Let your attention stay there near what's called the heart chakra for a moment. And place your attention on the mind, the mental consciousness. Within which the thoughts are rising. You may have some thoughts that involve the future, kind of thinking of what you want to do in the future. Some that are considering the past, remembering consciousness. Some thoughts that are involving the present, maybe what you're hearing or feeling right now. The first thing to do is to try to let go of your attention of the thoughts instead of focusing on them, as though turning your back on the thoughts and try to perceive the consciousness that's perceiving them, the subject mind rather than the objective thoughts. The nature of that subjective mind. When the thoughts are present, there has to be spaciousness of the mind to accommodate them. They don't displace that spaciousness of the mind. The mind that encompasses them is what is perceiving them. The clarity of that mind is what allows them to arise and what allows them easy escape when the thoughts begin to fade. When there arises naturally a few moments of quiet, clarity, focus on that, the clarity of the mind. Try to remember that. It doesn't have a shape or color. It's not black. It's not white. It's not blue. It's like empty space. Sometimes you can think it's like the surface of a clear mirror, a clean mirror. You've brushed it off. You've used your microfiber cloth to clean off the mirror. No smudges on it. Whatever you place before the mirror is reflected effortlessly in the mirror. The mirror doesn't have to do anything. That's another way to think of the clarity of the mind. defocus on the objective thoughts, refocus on the subjective mind, the nature of that mind that's perceiving them, like a vast space, unobstructing, clear and knowing. Occasionally your mind might pay attention to your body, the presence of your body, which always seems to be there, irrefutably. Recognize that your mental apprehension of the body, knowing about the body, recognizing its presence, is via a mental image, thought in your mind. You don't have to pay attention to that, just as you don't have to pay attention to the other thoughts. One way to let go of that is to ask yourself, what is the consciousness, what is the nature of the consciousness that's perceiving this body for an instant? Defocus on the objective thought, the body. Refocus on the spaciousness of the mind within which the body was perceived a moment earlier. So it's mental consciousness, a little part of the mental consciousness is watching, like a spy in the corner of the room, watching the rest of the mental consciousness. And as the thoughts begin to diminish in their intensity and in their frequency, how often they come, you're having a clearer and clearer appearance of the mind. Maybe you have a momentary apprehension of the body, but then that fades away into the nature of the mind, into that clarity. Like the womb or the matrix of the thoughts. Let go also of the thought of an observer, as though there is an I, me, the observer who's watching the mind. That too is a thought. Although we have to prove that to ourselves yet. You can just go on that assumption right now. That too is appearing to the mind. Try to defocus on that, the sense of an I, capital I, the letter I, ourself, and perceive the consciousness, the nature of the consciousness to which that I was appearing. even if your mind is overwhelmed with a multitude of thoughts or irritations or whatever, right at that moment, just turn your attention slightly to remind yourself all of this is appearing within the nature of the mind. And as though turning your back on the objective thoughts, try to perceive the subjective mind. And do this observation for a moment. Observe your breathing. Just watch it. Is it indeed more subtle, more slower, less forceful than it was earlier? And then turn your attention back to the consciousness that was observing that, the nature of that mind. Remind yourself that this is what can be called the conventional Buddha potential, Buddha nature. It's the continuity of this mind, or something similar to it, the subtlemost mind, that will eventually become the omniscient mind when we become enlightened. This is our Buddha potential, within which we can develop the good qualities, eliminate the faults. Feeling some joy, recognizing that, to feel gratitude to the Buddha who explained these facts, the fact that we have, generally, we don't recognize our life as one of incredible fortune, freedom from the lower realms, freedom from births that give us no chance to practice the Dharma, even as some kind of gods. And in being endowed with the existence of the teachings, the existence of spiritual community that can help. Having a lifetime when I have an interest in the Dharma, I have the capacity, because I have all my faculties intact, I have the capacity to practice it. Incredibly rare. That's what my situation is right now. So I'm going to make use of it this life, this year, this month, today, this very moment, to accumulate merit, purify my mind by listening to the teachings on the subject of lyric awareness and knowing. To heal myself, get rid of faults. And then as the mind has become less damaging to oneself and others, to develop positive qualities where you can definitely benefit oneself and others. I'm going to listen to the teachings so that I can become enlightened, where I can spontaneously, effortlessly work for the welfare of mother sentient beings, all of these beings who have been, are actually been our mother numberless times, just as kind as this life's mother. not content just to watch them continually suffer, circle in cyclic existence, but wanting to help them to escape. I think the only way that I could really do that is to become a Buddha, to become an Arhat. I'm incapable then, in a long period of time, not helping sentient beings. Again, let go of all those thoughts, those motivations. Just focus again on the clarity of the mind. The thoughts, the motivation fades into the clarity of your mind. And let it slowly reappear, fade back. Motivation to benefit sentient beings. And then relax your body, relax your mind, bring your attention back to the present. Any observations? Anyone want to make, have a question from before or some observation about the meditation? Anyone? No one ever asked questions about the meditation. Oh, okay. Were you indicating, the gentleman behind, were you indicating you couldn't hear? You were going like this? No? Yeah. Okay.
Just regarding something that I have learned before, I was taught that the mind doesn't look at itself. Only one moment sees the next moment. Mm-hmm. Then just now you gave the guide about observing the mind that's the subject and not the object, which are all the thoughts, right?
Right. Observe, trying to observe the nature of the mind, one part of the mind watching the nature of the mind.
So, I find myself asking, if the mind don't see itself, then who's doing the seeing?
If the mind what?
If the mind doesn't see itself, then who does the seeing? Because
so the mind does see itself.
I thought so, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. So there's difference though in the, like when we were talking about the subject earlier, the what we called the same subject Lohrig, when we called the kind of the epistemological part, when you talk about how you know, the ways of knowing, seven ways of knowing. Remember, there was one. Was there? Oh no, when we were talking about tenets, the tenets course, we were talking about. Oh, also here, there's a concept of what's called self-aware, self-cognizing, rangrik in Tibetan, as though there's one of the tenets, the Sautrantikas, for instance, postulate, they say that there is a capacity of a consciousness, every consciousness, primary consciousnesses, mental factors, anything that's consciousness, is aware of itself. It doesn't, it's not like analyzing itself. It's just like, it knows that it was thinking, or knows that it's perceiving, just knows itself. They postulate that. Higher tenets say that's not true. So why did the lower tenets, why do they say, and even some Chittamatra, even some of the higher tenets say that there is this, why do they say it's true? Because They say, well, there's memory. How would you know, say for instance, you might remember something that you saw, but how do you know that you saw it? You know, you might remember the objective thing, the book in the bookshop, or, you know, the dress in the store, or the computer you were looking at. But how do you know, how do you remember? Because we do remember, we saw those things, or heard those things, or tasted, or whatever. How do we do that? They postulate that you need to have this auto-cognition, self-knower. It's just a capacity of a consciousness. It was one of the... you know, one of the qualities of mind. So the people who refute that, the higher tenets, like, the, say, the Prasangika, Majjhamaka, and so forth, say that you don't have to postulate that. Simply having observed something and remembering what you observed with any of the senses or with the mental consciousness, that has implicit in it the memory of knowing it, perceiving it. So you don't need to postulate a separate quality of the mind that knows itself. So then your question comes up. You say, well, this sounds, what this American monk is saying, your mind is watching your mind. Sounds like self-knower, right? In one way. But I'm saying a corner of your mind. Can you hear okay? Yeah. Well, you can come sit over here. So it's possible for the mind to be partially aware of different things. Especially when the mind gets very calm, it can put a little of its attention. And we just have one, let's say, mental consciousness, but one part of the mind can be watching one thing, one can be watching another. But generally, a mind... Okay, we talk about cause and effect. How does a mind arise? It arises from a previous moment of mind. This little spy that I'm asking you to try to generate, little ability to watch the rest of the mind, is actually, let's say, the present moment of consciousness, one part of the present moment of consciousness, remembering the quality of the previous instant of mind. It's not watching the same time, because if it was watching the mind, say, here's the mind right now, a time, whatever this is, 2,700,000,000,000,000 seconds from the beginning, this sometime. So if there was a part of the mind watching this right now, this mind would be arising from a cause at the same time of itself. You know, you're knowing, let's say time one, right? Some big number. The part of the mind at time one is knowing the rest of the mind at time one. Then that would be, so this consciousness is arising as a result from watching something at the same time. Only some of the basic lower tenets believe that cause and effect can be simultaneous. What has to come first? The effect comes first, right? Then the cause? No, the opposite. The cause comes first, then the effect, right? The result. First you have a seed, then you have the sprout. First you have the fire, then you have the smoke, right? So, this is a case of, maybe even when you say part of the mind, maybe just some attention of instant number two, remembering just the previous instant of consciousness, its clarity. So that seems to be what is happening here, rather than talking about that. What you said, I read that, I heard that the mind cannot know itself. Very famous Shantideva in the Bodhisattvacharyavatara gives the example to refute self-knowing, gives the example, just as a sword, no matter how you try to wield it, cannot cut its own blade. And you might say, oh no, if you're clever, you can bend the sword. That may be cutting it at a different point. You know what I'm saying? One part of the blade, maybe it bends, and so that part of the blade is touching another part of the blade. It's not touching itself. It can't cut itself. So consciousness cannot cut itself. But one part of the blade can cut another part of the blade. So like that, one part of the mind is recognizing a previous instant of the consciousness. Does that make sense? That's how I understand it. So there's not a fault of contradicting. You know, the upper tenets say that there's no self-awareness, but that self-awareness is something that's simultaneous. It's knowing the consciousness at the same moment that the conscious event is going on. We don't accept that. Okay? We have to think. Yeah. Okay? So, we're talking about how many mental factors are there? 52, right? 51, okay. I'm just checking. Okay. Not 50, it's 52 weeks in a year, right? That's the way you can remember. It's not 52. Then you might think it's 53. I don't know. You have to remember it's 51. So we talked about the five omnipresent mental factors, right, that are present in any consciousness, the sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. Anytime the mind, the only time they might not be present is when you're about to fall asleep. Some of the your consciousness is only partially there. You know, like when you're about to nod off, moments like that, or when. Similar situations like that, but generally they are always present. That's why they could be called, translated into English, omnipresent mental factors. So we went over that a little bit, and then we mentioned that there are another set of five that I call the object ascertaining mental factors. Did we start going through this list last time? The five omnipresent mental factors are present in all consciousness. The next set of five also can be present in the sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. It can be present, but it isn't always present. It's only present when one of those consciousnesses is knowing something. So they can bring about some understanding of it, better understanding it. So there are five of those. So there's, the list could be given a different way. So the first one could be called aspiration. Aspiration. You could also translate that as wishing. Dumpa in Tibetan. So this is interesting. Aspiration. Remember there was that fellow in Iraq many years ago, the Hussein, Saddam Hussein, he wanted to make the mother of all wars. He said something like that. Do you remember that expression? Maybe some of you are too young. You remember that, right? The mother of all wars. So sometimes aspiration is called the mother of all virtuous actions. Aspiration. So this is a mental factor. Let me see. Read what Jeffrey Hopkins says. Aspiration observes a contemplated phenomenon, you know, some object, and seeks it. It has the aspect of wanting to get, right? Aspiring. Do you know what that means, to aspire? You aspire to something, you want it, you desire it. It's not attachment, you know, that you might think attachment is what sometimes moves you towards something. You could call this desire, but there's another word we often translate for desire, just dukkha, which is part of the word for attachment. In Tibetan, the word for attachment is duchak, so it's kind of like a clinging desire in the case of attachment. This is more like aspiration. Aspiration observes something that's been contemplated, that you thought about, and seeks it. So why would it seek it? It must have perceived at a previous moment, seen some qualities in it that create this aspiration in you. Okay? Aspiration serves as a base for the initiation of effort. Okay, so this is interesting. When we talk, have you studied sometime the stages of developing shamatha? Did you ever have a course on that? Where they had 9 stages or these different things. So at the beginning, they say that there are certain faults. What's the first fault that prevents you from developing shamatha? Is it Belinda or Brilinda? Belinda, you know? Did you ever study? So there are said to be 5 faults that have to be overcome to develop calm abiding, you know, really good concentration, which we'd like to do, right? What's the first fault? Laziness, right? Tibetan is a nice name. Lelo almost sounds like lay. The first syllable is the same. Lelo. Lelo is laziness. So what are the antidotes to laziness? They say, well, in terms of overcoming the laziness that prevents you from getting involved with, you know, with concentration. First, you don't have any reason. You don't see the virtuous qualities of it, so you have no reason to put energy into meditating. So the first antidote to laziness is a kind of faith. Having heard about the good qualities of, you know, meditation, calm abiding, calm mind, you develop some faith that this is something, especially the faith that's wishing to achieve this. That's what's the other one called? Admiring that, you know, the faith of admiration. Like, that's something I'd like to get. Then, as a result of that, so there are 4 antidotes to laziness, right? There were 5 faults altogether. The first fault is laziness. There are 4 antidotes. First antidote is faith, kind of admiring the qualities of it. Then, as a result of that, when you're thinking and have some confidence, some faith in the qualities of that, you develop an aspiration. You think, yeah, I should get that. I should have that. I want that. I aspire for that. That's the second antidote to laziness. So that's this mental factor in that particular context. That's not the only way this mental factor acts. It acts in many other ways also, but just to give you, maybe to connect with some things you've heard before. So that aspiration then, based on faith of admiring the qualities, that gives rise to effort, to what do we call joyous effort. Right, that's also the name of one of the virtuous mental factors, the name of one of the perfections, the 6 bodhisattva perfections, right? Effort. So how does that joyous effort in doing this long, arduous path to develop concentration, there's a lot of obstacles, things that you have to do, how does that effort get generated and be sustained? By aspiration, wanting to attain it. You know, like, you're also a business person, businesswoman, businessman, they're aspiring to make money, right? And so, even there's all sorts of obstacles, they put effort, they work, 9 to 5 or 8 to 6 or 7 to 7, longer hours, many, many hours, all hours of the day and night. They put effort because they want that goal. So the aspiration acts as the instigator of effort. That's why I said, and the effort is here when we talk about a positive aspiration, not just the aspiration for money or worldly things, but the aspiration for virtuous qualities. That effort becomes joyous effort, which is aiming for, you know, which is happy to engage in virtue. And so that's like, it's like the mother, aspiration is like the mother of all good qualities, because the good qualities come about from effort, which come about from aspiration. And the aspiration was first developed because, you remember, it says here, aspiration observes something, something that you've contemplated, and seeks it. You can't be seeking something that you haven't thought about. So you first have that faith that admires something. You see some good qualities, like if in the worldly sense, money, the Dharma sense, maybe tranquil abiding, you develop some appreciation of that. Wow, that's really good. Then aspiration, I should attain that. Then you get effort. Then the fruit of that effort, those are the first three of the four antidotes of laziness. And what's the fourth antidote? Yeah, pliancy. Well, you say, what's pliancy? Not appliance. That's something that's like your vacuum cleaner or something. Right? Pliancy. You know, if you say someone is pliant, they're easily movable. Or if something is stiff, you say it's not pliant. If you heat it up, maybe it becomes like some plastic that you can mold. It becomes more pliant. So pliancy refers to the quality of mind and body that arise as you get to the higher stages, getting close to achieving calm abiding. When you have pliancy of mind and pliancy of body, you can work, you can walk without hindrance. You can even walk very fast. I said, you know, have you ever heard in Tibet they talk about these people? I can't remember what was it. I think they call it lungom. Lung means air. Gom can mean to walk. So have you ever heard of these people? Like they set out in the morning and they walk continuously without stopping for 2 days or something like that because of some kind of special quality, maybe because they've developed a certain pliancy of body. They can do that. We can't do that now. Your body would get exhausted. But it's possible to develop that. Also pliancy of mind, so the mind doesn't feel any hesitancy to analyze something all over the place again and again, as though you would feel no hesitancy to count every atom in the wall. Every brick in the wall might seem daunting, but every particle of every brick, you know, the mind has that kind of pliancy. That is the fourth antidote. That's the, I would say, the actual antidote of laziness. Faith that admires the qualities, giving rise to aspiration, giving rise to effort. That effort then culminates in you achieving that pliancy of body and mind that really is the antidote to laziness. Then there's no hesitancy to engage in objects, in any kind of practices. So the first of these object-ascertaining mental factors is called aspiration. So it doesn't, again, it is not limited to simply talking about calm abiding or obtaining those states, but it's also, the mother that gives rise to positive effort, joyous effort that gets all other kind of qualities. You need to have aspiration. But you can have, aspiration is not necessarily virtuous, right? You can aspire for fame just for this, you know, not even talking about to benefit others, just for your own. You can you know, aspire to have power over others or aspire to be the most admired person. You know, you can have all sorts of aspirations that are negative. So it's not these. What about the omnipresent mental factor, omnipresent mental factors? Are they virtuous or non-virtuous? Last time we talked about the omnipresent mental factors that are always present, right? Feeling and, you know, so forth. Intention, attention, contact. Are they virtuous or non-virtuous? Or are they neutral? You could say, by their nature, they're neutral, but they can become virtuous or non-virtuous by, for instance, being present in a mind, in a consciousness, let's say a mental consciousness that is virtuous. The feeling in that mental consciousness, by virtue of bearing similarities with the five similarities, bearing similarities with that virtuous mind, becomes virtuous. Okay, but so these, by their nature, are not necessarily virtuous or non-virtuous. They could be either, but it depends the situation. So the first one's called aspiration. Second, object ascertaining factor. Second one is called, his Tibetan name is Mubha, and we translate that, Jeffrey here translates it as belief. I like to translate it as appreciation. I think he's also translated it as, that's kind of the appreciation. Remember I said the faith that appreciates the good qualities, say, of samadhi, and therefore gives rise to the aspiration for it. So this one, you could call it belief or appreciation. Belief or appreciation holds an ascertained object. So again, this means, this arises once you have... Excuse me. Once you've ascertained something, you've recognized some object, belief holds an ascertained object to be just as it was ascertained. So maybe in certain sense, belief, appreciation sounds, it would be, now that I think of it, would seem to be applicable when you have a belief that something is good. Right, you appreciate it. If you have a belief that something is bad, you wouldn't call it appreciation, right? So maybe I'll begin to change my translation. So go along more with Jeffrey's translation here. Belief. So you can have a positive belief that would be appreciate something. You've ascertained it. You hold that object to be just as it was understood. So you believe that. That's also what we call belief also, right? So remember in the seven ways of knowing, there was one way of knowing called correct belief. Do you remember that? What else did we call that? Presumption. Presumption doesn't necessarily give the feeling that it's correct, because you could presume things that are wrong. Correct presumption, assumption. So like that's usually how we know things now. We haven't realized them. Remember when we talked about that before? Weijin, do you remember? Yeah. So is that this mental factor? Sort of related with it, but that's a general state of mind. This is a particular mental factor that has this function of holding an object to be just as it was ascertained before. That's how it is. So believing that, and functions to keep the mind from being pulled off to being captivated by another view of it. Like, say, believing this is the so I've got these high class glasses one friend offered. So these are like, oh, I believe I have this that these are the best glasses. And if you show me some other glasses, you know, what glasses do you have? What brand? Yeah, no, they're not as good as I believe these are best. You try to say, no, these are better. But this belief holds this to be just as I believed it when they said, oh, these are the best glasses you can get, you know, or really, maybe not the best, but good glasses. I believe this, and it prevents, that belief prevents me from being captivated by another view, the view that might think, oh, maybe your glasses are better. Do you see what I'm saying? Just giving a trivial example. So belief, this mental factor or appreciation, belief, appreciation, holds something to be just as you'd originally had considered it to be and functions to prevent you being, so holding it really, you know, yeah, that's how it is, prevents you being swayed by some other view, something else, that this is not that way. You're believing this, you're holding that. Does that make sense? Was it Jeremy? I can't remember back there who we talked last time. Yeah, is it Jeremy? Raymond. Do you understand? Yeah? Try. Okay. Do you understand? No, okay. So, the first one you understood, right? Aspiration, a little bit. Okay, okay. If you had said no on that one, I was okay. So this one. What else can I say? So when you have a belief in something, like say you believe if you're a Christian, you believe maybe you believe Christ came to wash away our sins, that Christ died on the cross for us or something. We Buddhists believe that there are past and future lives. So that belief is something that holds, that ascertains, something that we've previously come to understand, you know, like oh yeah, past and future lives exist. We've been somehow convinced of that, and so our mind holds it. That's how it is, you know. That's belief. That's what we say. I believe that. Yeah, we hold that. And it has the function, that belief, it functions to keep us being, you know, captivated by some other. You know, oh, you should become Muslim or you should become Buddhist or something. If you have very strong belief as a Christian, you won't be captivated by some other view that's contrary to what you believe. Does that make a little sense? Huh? What'd she say? You know, just the way that we use belief. You know, like I believe in God. Do people say that? Or I believe in reincarnation. I might ask the crowd sometime, do you believe in reincarnation? Some people say yes, some people say no, some people say I'm not sure. So belief is something that is holding something that you've previously been convinced of. You know, somehow you say, oh yeah, that's right, and now you believe that. It has the function of holding that as it was believed, as it was originally, you were originally convinced of, and because of that, you know, you're adamant, you're holding that, and you won't be swayed by other ideas that are contradictory. Okay, well, you think about it if it's not quite clear yet. For instance, Jeffrey says, for instance, when one considers Buddha and other teachers and analyzes to discover which is an undeceiving refuge, is Indra, or is Brahma an undeceiving refuge? Is Mara an undeceiving refuge? Or was Buddha or the founder of the Jain religion? When one analyzes these different teachers to discover which is an undeceiving refuge, totally reliable, will never let you down, one ascertains that only Buddha is the teacher of an undeceiving refuge. Well, what does he teach? You know, the Dharma, the holy Dharma, the Buddha Dharma. It's something you might believe just because I said it, or maybe you don't believe it because I said it. You know, anything he thinks, I'm not going to believe. But if you say, if the Dalai Lama said something, you might believe it just on the mere words. That's not very strong belief. But you may have reasons to hold that belief, so that belief can increase, that mental factor belief. Then when the doctrine taught by him, the Buddha, and the spiritual community, the Sangha, properly achieving his doctrine, are ascertained by valid cognition as undeceiving, a firm belief in them, that's when you develop a firm belief in them as a final refuge is gained. Yeah, generally, when we talk about refuge, what are the causes of refuge? How many causes are there? What? You put up some fingers, right? I couldn't see how many. Yeah, so the one is fear or preoccupation of some suffering, whether it be the suffering of being born in the lower realms next lifetime, or even born in cyclic existence in general. Oh my gosh, it's going to be like this forever. Or the fear of falling into the hearer or solitary realizer's peace, where you wouldn't be able to help sentient beings. Those are the three kinds of fear. The second cause is faith that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can protect you from those fears. Right? Those are usually when we say the two words. But here also we say, before you have faith, you have a kind of hope that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you need at least hope. You know, the first time you hear about it, if you have immediate faith, you're just like someone who's like blind faith kind of person. But what would arise before the faith would be kind of like, that would be nice if the Buddha could do that. I kind of like hope. And then that hope can turn into a belief. When it becomes a firm belief, that can give rise to faith. The cause of refuge. So some commentaries about taking refuge, they say you need at least, you need fear, some apprehension about something that you need refuge from, because you take refuge to protect you from something, from some fear, right? And at least you need hope, most elemental. hope, if you continue to practice, can become belief that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can protect you, and then that can become faith. Then you have a proper refuge. You're taking it from the depth of your heart. Otherwise, it's not from the depth of your heart, just initial sort of thing. Once you've ascertained that only the Buddha is a teacher of undeceiving refuge, then the doctrine which is taught by him, was taught by him, and the spiritual community who properly achieve his doctrine, means the Sangha, right? When they are ascertained by valid cognition as undeceiving, well, that takes a long time to have a valid cognition of that, a firm belief in them as a final refuge is gained. So that firm belief can become then that faith that is a cause of refuge. Thereupon the forders, the other non-Buddhist schools, cannot lead one away from this position. That's the other quality of belief, right? It has the function of not being captivated by other views. So if you have strong belief that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are undeceiving refuge, faith in that, you can't be swayed by other people tell you, oh, there's a new religion that's come up in Korea, or a rock band is teaching it, or, you know, or someone in America has discovered. You won't be swayed by that. One has then entered among the number of Buddhists. One becomes a Buddhist, and based on this, all auspicious qualities increase. Okay, so we talked about aspiration and belief or appreciation. Those are two of the object ascertaining factors. Well, so what does that mean? If you know something, they will be present in the retinue of that primary consciousness. Remember the word retinue I used before? Kind of like, was it entourage? They are amongst the qualities within that consciousness. Part of the consciousness, the bare, just primary consciousness is knowing just the bare perceptual field. And then other parts of the consciousness are feeling and discriminating. Also one is aspiring. They could be, you know, more prominent or less prominent, but these five will be present when you know an object, in addition to the five omnipresent mental factors. Third one is what we've talked about before, and we even talked about it in a course over a couple of days, mindfulness. Mindfulness. This is the better word, dhamma. In Sanskrit, do anyone remember what the Sanskrit was? Or the Pali? We talked about it when we talked about four close placements of mindfulness. In Pali, they're called satipatthana, right? Sati in Pali. In Sanskrit, it's smirti. There's no I in smirti. There's a vowel in Sanskrit. Do you know that? Vowel R. It sounds like ri, like sounds like ri. That's how you sometimes, if you write it out, it looks like smri, but it's actually smr, the vowel r. You know, would you say? Do you say the blessing of the speech sometime? You say the vowels a e u ri. Those are vowels. So that ri. That's this vowel, like in smirti, sm. This. T-I, Smriti. In Pali, that becomes Sati. So mindfulness is non-forgetfulness with respect to a familiar object. So this is very, very interesting. So you can only be mindful of something that you already are familiar with. You've already recognized, maybe you have some appreciation for it. That's why the mindfulness will be strong. You know, you appreciate its qualities. Maybe you have an aspiration for it. Mindfulness is a mental factor of non-forgetfulness with respect to a familiar phenomenon, singular phenomenon. So, for instance, you might be mindful of your breathing. So once you've watched the breathing, you try to develop this mental factor of mindfulness, which sort of is like a glue that keeps you on that, so you don't forget the object. Otherwise, you've been aware of something, and then your mind wanders onto something else. Mindfulness is what keeps you on the object, kind of like the glue, right? It has the function of causing non-distraction. So, is the object of mindfulness something that you've never encountered before? Can you be mindful of that? Well, not until you know it. The first instant, you can't have mindfulness of it. Once you've encountered something, a new concept or something that some instruction to listen to the mantra you're saying or to observe a certain part of your body. At first, you have to observe that, and then once it's been familiar, you've familiarized with that, and maybe you're motivated through some other factor, aspiration or appreciation, you try to keep that in mind. Maybe you have a particular purpose. Mindfulness is the most important factor in developing single-pointed concentration, shamatha. We mentioned these terms again and again. Mindfulness is like what allows you to keep, let's say if you're trying to, maybe you're meditating, you're visualizing Shakyamuni Buddha in front, little teeny Shakyamuni Buddha about one body length in front of you at the level of your brow. Very small, because that causes you to concentrate more. Just here, there's some special purpose. So you get familiar with that image. You know, you look at pictures, and then you try to imagine it, and very small out here. Then when you get familiar with that, you can develop not just memory. You could also translate the word smirti or nimba as memory, because it can apply to memory. But mindfulness means, well, memory has a different function, right? It's bringing back something, bringing it to the present. You say, oh, can I remember? Why can't I remember that or this? It's still the same word, but a different quality, memory. This is mindfulness. That means it's keeping in mind something that you've become familiar with and not letting your mind get distracted to something else. You know, there's a famous story expressed by this, that some king, hypothetical king maybe, in ancient time, I'm not sure whether he did out of spite or for some reason, I can't remember the whole story, but he told the servant he had to carry this bowl of sesame oil to the brim to his queen or something like that without spilling a drop. Have you ever had to, you know, when you carry to the table, you go to the restaurant, you get some water, if the water is below the level of the lip, there's no problem, bring it to the table without spilling. But if it's right to the lip, you got to be, you know, someone, you get distracted, you spill, right? So the king said, if you spill one drop of the sesame oil, you will be beheaded. So what does that person, what does they have to, what do they need in order to fulfill that? They need mindfulness. They have to be mindful all the time of where the oil is. Even pretty little doggy comes by, turtle, you might be distracted to that other times. Mindfulness of this is so strong, you know, because you're afraid your head's going to be chopped off. So mindfulness can be enhanced by, you know, by understanding the qualities of you want and the defects of letting go of the object. But it's the glue that helps you to keep that object in mind, mindfulness. Okay. So what have we had so far? How many? Three, right? Aspiration, belief or appreciation, and mindfulness. Now the next one is what's called samadhi. Have you ever heard samadhi? It's not the same word as shamatha. Shamatha is calm abiding, right? It's not the same word as dhyana, like, or jhana. It's like some kind of meditational absorption, like of the form or formless realms. Samadhi is a word that people often in the West know for some reason. It means it can mean single-pointed concentration. Here, how did Jeffrey translate it? Stabilization. I think sometimes he's also translated it as meditative stabilization. Or originally we just called it single-pointed concentration, because in the definition the word of single-pointed comes up in the definition of samadhi. Samadhi, or stabilization, meditative stabilization, one-pointed concentration, is a one-pointedness of mind. What does that mean, one-pointedness? With respect to an imputed object. An imputed object. That means not an object. Oh, okay, we'll leave it for then. Yeah. It has the function of serving as the base of knowledge. That is, it serves as the base of vipassana, special insight, higher insight. What's the other word we translate vipassana? Higher insight? How do we translate in the basic program? How do they translate vipassana? Or lakton? Special insight? Anyway, okay. So what does this mean? The object of stabilization is specified as imputed because when meditative stabilization is cultivated, the mind is held to a mentally imputed or imagined object of observation. This indicates that meditative stabilization is not generated by a sense consciousness. Sense consciousness has samadhi, but not the meditative stabilization, like, for instance, that gives rise to shamatha. A little bit different. There is a factor of samadhi that keeps the mind continually, the visual consciousness continually on an object, but you cannot develop shamatha. You know what shamatha is, right? Calm abiding. You can't develop shamatha by concentrating with your eye consciousness on a candle. I think some non-Buddhist schools, people think that. There was even a book by maybe Sogyal Rinpoche talked about one of his gurus when he was a little boy who developed single-pointed concentration by being in a dark room and just looking at a candle, you know, not letting his eye waver. From the very famous, you know, in Asanga's writing, the famous Mahayana saint Asanga, who wrote the Abhidhamma Samuchaya, the brother of Vasubandhu, Asanga said that meditative stabilization, so there is samadhi here, but not the same. When you talk about meditative stabilization, you're talking about the samadhi that's in the mental consciousness that's going to bring about tranquil abiding. That does not take a impermanent object that's moving as its object. I remember when people were so fascinated with these Satipatthana courses, watching the breathing. I remember Lama Yeshe's saying, you cannot generate samadhi watching the breath. So very interesting. So, but there's supposedly mindfulness of the breathing can supposedly lead you to single-pointed concentration, to shamatha. So what's the difference? The breathing is something moving, right? Here it says that stabilization is a one-pointedness of mind. That means it doesn't go from one thing to another. Just one, single-pointed. Do we say that? That person is single-pointed. They're only thinking about getting to on vacation. Anything else comes up, you know, single-pointed, or making money or whatever. With respect to an imputed object, that means something, a mental image. So to develop tranquil abiding, you need to have a mental image which is unchanging. If it's changing, how are you going to... This was Lama's point. If it's changing, like the breathing, how can you develop single-pointed, one-pointed concentration as it's changing? So Alan Wallace did some research about this. I remember reading his some either talking to him or hearing him or reading something that he wrote, that he had gone to, I think originally Sri Lanka, and inquired with the monks there this seeming dilemma, you know, how could you develop shamatha on the basis of something that's moving? And they say, no, you get familiar by watching the breathing, you get familiar with what? The air element. You know there are four elements? What are they called? Wind or air? What are they? Fire, earth, water. Four elements. So the air element, its function is to move. The earth element, its function is to provide solidity, you know, firmness. The water element provides cohesion wherever, because if you take water, you know, if you drop a water, it'll come back together again. It has its nature is to be cohesive. It's like the fire element, nature is heat, right? So you get familiar with you're getting a familiarity with the air element, the wind element, by watching the breathing, and over time you develop a mental image which is permanent. Remember we talked about mental image is permanent, of the air element. And even these monks that Ellen had sort of questioned in Sri Lanka, they said, that's what you're, at the end, that's when you develop shamatha. You can't develop shamatha just on the breathing itself. So both Lama Yeshe and Alan Wallace were right, both right. So at the beginning, you're just getting familiar with the air element. You're getting a mental image of what that means, that mobility or movement. You get a mental image of that, and it's upon that, you give up. You're not watching the breathing any longer at that point. You develop your single-pointed concentration. Instead of an image of the Buddha, you have an image, a mental image of the air element. Does that make sense? Maybe not. Does it make sense? You're hard to convince. Are you guys lost over there? Is it making sense? Something? Okay. This indicates that meditative stabilization is not generated by a sense consciousness, such as an eye consciousness staring at an object, but by the mental consciousness observing an internal object. So what could have happened with this guru of Sogyal Rinpoche, who said he developed single-pointed concentration, concentrating on the candle? You don't generate meditative concentration, shamatha, with the eye consciousness. But maybe he developed a mental image by looking at it at a long time of that, and by concentrating on that as his object, maybe. You know, who knows if he actually developed, you know, single-pointed concentration. If he did, it would be something like that. Through continuous cultivation of meditative stabilization, the object of observation, whether true or untrue, will be perceived clearly and non-conceptually. What does that mean? How could you have an object of observation that was untrue? What could you be thinking about that's untrue? Every time it's like you say it when I turn my head so I don't see who said it. I can't understand. What's she saying? No faith. Okay. How about the horns of a rabbit? Does a rabbit have horns? Do you can imagine why someone might think a rabbit had horns? You know, in the foggy morning, you haven't had your coffee yet, you come out, look out the window, there's this little rabbit with these little things in the fog. Oh my gosh, that little thing has horns. Does it have horns? No. you're mistaking maybe the ears or some story you heard. And so you have a mental image of the horns of a rabbit. This is the classic example in Buddhism of something that doesn't exist. You know, they say, that doesn't exist. That's like the horns of a rabbit, you know. I remember once when we were studying tenets at Manjushri Institute, Geshe Tekchok, who went on to become the abbot of Sera, he liked to joke. He was a big lama. And there was one German monk in the front. I can't remember his name right now. He'll come to me. And he sometimes would burst out laughing if you teased him. While we were saying the prayers, Geshe Tekchok took this postcard and he showed it to, Helmut. Showed it to Helmut. And it was of a rabbit with horns, like something photoshopped, right? And we didn't know. He was just showing it to him because we'd been talking in the class that came up. It's a classic example in the scriptures talking about something that's non-existent. Can you have a mental image of the horns of a rabbit? Yeah, you can imagine that. There's a mental image. But remember when we talked about conception, a correct conception, let's say if I have a conception of this cup, I'm knowing the cup via the mental image of the cup. So there is something corresponding to the mental image that does exist. Or like my mother's face, something corresponding to that that does exist. But you can also have the mental image of something that doesn't exist. Then, although you think there's something out there, the horns of a rabbit, that this mental image is referring to, there's no actual conceived object. There's just an appearing object to that conception, right? You might say there's only an imputed conceived object, you know, supposed horns of a rabbit, but to be an object, something has to exist. And there's no horns of a rabbit. Horns of a rabbit do not exist. Unless just to prove me wrong, you've gone to the laboratory and cloned a rabbit with a moose or something like that. There, George, horns of a rabbit. That wouldn't be a rabbit, that would be, what did they call that? I can't remember. What? Mutant. Mutant, right? Mutant turtle, mutant rabbit. Okay. So saying that, you might think, well, samadhi is not, this mental factor is called samadhi, right? Then it sounds like samadhi is not in the sense consciousness, but that's not the case. There is samadhi there, but not the samadhi that gives rise to tranquil abiding. This is an object ascertaining factor, and it's like the result of mindfulness. Keeping something in mind, mindfulness is the glue. Samadhi is a mental factor that keeps a continuity of that, that provides that continuity. Like you're perceiving something, your eye consciousness has a continuity on one thing rather than jumping onto something else. So it's related to that. But it does, the samadhi, the mental factor samadhi, in the sense consciousnesses, is not used to develop single-pointed concentration, meditative stabilization in the mental consciousness. A little bit subtle, I'm not sure. Independence on the meditative stabilization of calm abiding, right, tranquil abiding, which is a setting of the mind internally in equipoise, one can develop special insight, special insight, vipassana, that is achieved through the force of analytical wisdom. Therefore, the function of samadhi, in terms of the mental consciousness, is specified as serving as the base of knowledge. Because when we talk about the three higher trainings, remember ethics, morality, concentration, like samadhi, wisdom, they each act as the support of the... In order to develop concentration, you need ethics. Because in practicing ethics, you hone your mindfulness, which is a necessary factor to develop samadhi. Also, you subdue the distractive thoughts, you know, the worries and so forth. then you can develop concentration. And then when you have concentration, you can develop insight, you know, wisdom, that let's say that realizes impermanence, subtle impermanence, or emptiness. Okay? So how many is that so far? It's four, right? Yes. Is there that microphone? Yeah. Yeah, he'll read to you. Please, preach to her. We. Chi Wen Chi. Chi Wei Chin. Four. Oh, you're just saying four. Okay. So, what is it? Aspiration, appreciation, mindfulness, and then samadhi or stabilization. Here, there's a slight difference between samadhi in the senses. They can't give rise to calm abiding, but the samadhi factor in the mental consciousness can give rise to that, what we could call meditative stabilization, maybe if you add it like that. Because the sense consciousnesses don't meditate, let's say.
Brother George, is belief and faith the same? Belief and faith the same?
No. Because you can have belief in wrong things. You can believe. You can believe that there are no past and future lives. You can believe that Donald Trump is actually Christ. I don't know. You can believe things. I don't know. I don't think he is. But I don't believe that. But you can believe wrong things. Faith is a virtuous mental factor, and although we use it colloquially, you know, sometimes we might think that having faith in something that's wrong is that mental factor. The virtuous mental factor, faith, is a state of mind, kind of, it's an intensification of belief about a true object. Okay.
Can I say that a correct belief is the same as faith or conviction? A correct belief is the same as faith or conviction because both are virtues.
So what he's reading from, you remember what we talked to some of it, we talked in the Luri class. Correct, you said correct belief?
Yes.
Correct belief.
Yes.
That was what we were talking about earlier. That's a general state of mind, not necessarily a mental factor. The whole state of mind, all of the analysis that has brought about belief in something. Belief is a particular mental factor that is present when you have correct belief. It's also present when you have wrong belief, the mental factor belief. And then you said, is that correct belief the same as
Faith of conviction.
So we're going to be talking, when we talk about the virtuous mental factors, we're going to talk about there are various kinds of faith. One of which, the really strong one is the faith of conviction. Let's say we call clear faith, or let's say lucid faith, faith of conviction. A faith aspiring or desiring for something. The possession of qualities. Or the faith that the certain objects such as the Buddha and so forth possesses qualities that brings about a calmness of the mind. So the faith of conviction is the one which is considered to be most stable. You've become convinced of something through reasons. Okay? So there is an element in that faith of the way of knowing called correct belief that would be present in faith, but it would that mental factor. So there's a difference between the way of knowing, which is talking about a general, the whole, all of the complex factors of the mind that would be present when we talk about a way of knowing. Here we're talking about that those particular mental factors that are present in the consciousness. So faith has a very, we'll talk about that in a little while. So let me just finish up with the fifth of these object ascertaining ones, and that is what we generally call wisdom. Cherub, have you heard of that? You know anyone named Cherub? Is that your name? Geshe Cherub. Oh yeah, Geshe Cherub, my old friend. From Copan? Cherub Dawa. Yeah, common name. Cherub is a Tibetan word that means wisdom. You know the Sanskrit? Prajna, like we talked about the Prajna Paramita, perfection of wisdom. Cherub. It's the sixth of this of the six perfections. It's the sixth, or if you talk about the tenth perfection, it's the sixth perfection, perfection of wisdom. Prajna Paramita. So wisdom is that which individually differentiates faults and virtues of objects of analysis. It has the function of overcoming doubt. But it's still present. Can still be present in the sense consciousnesses. It has a slightly, it has a more, has a different function in the sense consciousness. When you talk about it in the mental consciousness, it's that which, you know, you use your wisdom to see the faults of maybe breaking your vows, the virtues, the benefits of keeping them. You develop an understanding through wisdom, the power of wisdom. Wisdom is like, is similar to discrimination, but it has a finer power. Remember the mental factor discrimination that was one of the omnipresent mental factors. That can discriminate one thing from another. But here, wisdom individually differentiates the faults and virtues of things, or the qualities, the not necessarily, if you think, just only faults and virtues, the qualities of something. It can differentiate those, both the good things and the bad things. It has the function of overcoming doubt. So differentiation, the mental factor differentiation that's the omnipresent mental factor, just, let's say, in the mental factor, in the mental consciousness can differentiate from one thing from another, but the wisdom is something that uses differentiation, that mental factor to analyze something. And it has the function of overcoming doubt. When one analyzes with reasoning and gains ascertainment, certainty, doubt is overcome. When you develop certainty, when you analyze something, you know, is this recipe going to give me indigestion? You analyze the ingredients and you say, no, it's okay. I'm just going to take out that element and replace it with something else, with yogurt. Take out the oil, replace it with yogurt. Okay, then I'll be okay. You analyze it, you get certainty. Oh, that should be okay. So in that case, doubt is overcome. Thus, the function of knowledge or wisdom is specified as overcoming doubt. Okay, so those are the five object ascertaining mental factors. Now I want to skip. We're going to skip the virtuous mental factors right now, just to mention something practical about the non-virtuous mental factors. So there, how many virtuous mental factors were there? Are there? We haven't gone through the list yet. There are 11. Okay. So then we go to, next we're going to, I'm just going to mention the list of the six root delusions, right? Remember we talked a little bit about the six root delusions? what we said, there were five non-views and five views, or you could say six delusions: ignorance, attachment, anger, pride, afflicted doubt, those five non-views, and then five views that they're called afflicted view. And so that afflicted view has five, including wrong view and view of the transitory collection and so forth. So let's talk about anger of those. Anger is a particular state of mind that's defined as a klesha, one of these. Klesha means one of disturbing affliction, disturbing state of mind. It does not take place in the sense consciousnesses, although sometimes you might argue that. It's just something that's in the mental consciousness. Anger has observed something which you have found unpleasant and wants to be rid of it. And because of that, it observed something that's unpleasant and exaggerated the faults of that thing. You know, like they say, someone said harsh words to you, and then you look at them and say, what did that person, who do they think they are? I am good, you know. That person doesn't appreciate my good qualities. You know, your mind starts in what's called inappropriate attention. We'll talk about it in some other context. You ever hear that expression, inappropriate attention? Instead of paying attention to something in the proper way, you're letting your delusions, wrong analysis go on. And because of that, you exaggerate the faults of something. And because of that, the mind finds some inability to keep its tranquility, wants to get rid of that. You know, maybe say sharp words or strike out. Or if you hold it in and smile, it's like the jack-in-the-box we talked about. You know, you're repressing that anger. It's going to come out sooner or later. Maybe you'll get a tummy ache. You'll have some, you know, it'll come out as some physical symptom, or you'll get depression. You don't know why. You can't sleep. Or you'll break out in a rash or something like that. But sooner or later, that anger, if you repress it, will come out, will be enacted. Anger is considered to be the most destructive, immediately destructive, most dangerous of the afflictions, because it creates negative karma, like the other non-virtuous mental factors, attachment, you know, ignorance and so forth. Can. But it has the added fault of destroying our store of virtuous karma. We might have created it at a much different time, in a different situation. It's as though it's not just going to burn up the virtuous karma you created today, when you get angry today. It can burn up and cause to become less potent or postpone the ripening of virtuous karma that you created long time ago, some seeds of karma, virtuous seeds on your mind, almost like that fire of anger, you know, is roasting everything, all the virtuous seeds in your mental consciousness. Unfortunately, it does not function to roast the non-virtuous seeds. You might think, oh, if it roasts the virtuous seeds, as I have so few, I might as well get angry, because maybe it'll roast the non-virtuous seeds that I can purify. No, it doesn't work that way. What roasts, heats up, and makes impotent the non-virtuous seeds? Yeah. Wisdom, yeah. But particularly the mental factor regret. Yeah. Of the four opponent forces, that's the main thing. All the rest also add to prevent the seeds from ripening, the negative seeds. But the main thing, kind of like the equivalent of The equivalent of anger. So anger is kind of like a fire that can burn up the power of our virtuous karma. And what can burn up the power of our negative karma is regret. Thinking, whoa, why did I do that? I shouldn't have done that. And for various reasons. Maybe at first it's completely self-centered. Oh, I'm going to suffer in the future. Well, it's still legitimate, that purifies. Or you can think, oh, having created that action, I'm not going to be able to make the realizations so that I can help sentient beings. Higher, a more sophisticated regret that will burn them up even more. So anger is considered to be especially heinous. There's this TV program we watch as kids. It's been on, I think, for 30 or 40 years. What is it called? Special Victims Unit, on TV. They say, this dedicated squad of police in New York City are dedicated to fighting this particularly vicious crimes, some kind of sex crimes or something like that. So that phrase came to mind, especially vicious, especially heinous crimes. So it's considered to be especially heinous or terrible because not only does it create negative karma, anger, it burns up virtuous karma. So how can we, practically speaking, how can we apply an antidote to that? So Cici was mentioning when you talked about burning up karma, she was saying wisdom. So wisdom is an antidote of all of the delusions. Let's say the wisdom that realizes selflessness, even the wisdom that realizes impermanence can cause the delusions to subside, but not necessarily to pull them up from the root. But the wisdom that realizes selflessness of the person, the wisdom that realizes the emptiness of phenomena, that can eliminate anger. Even when it's present in the mind, if you can turn your attention away from the object of anger, you're so involved with it, and you remember that you yourself, who is now getting angry, you yourself do not exist the way that your mind is apprehending right now. Even right then, anger could disappear in an instant. You recognize the object or the situation that you're getting angry about. It's not necessarily a person, it might be the situation, something. As you realize that, it doesn't exist the way that it appears, that it is merely imputed. That can get rid of it. But there was one famous Kadampa Geshe Chengawa. Have you ever heard that name? Geshe Chengawa? Probably it was a common teaching of the Kadampas, but he had something called the four methods of patience. So patience is the main antidote to overcome anger, right? You could just say, put them all under the umbrella of patience. So there's one called the arrow and the target. Have you heard of this before? Shrikim, you ever hear? These four Kadampa special sort of oral tradition to antidotes to anger. The one is called the arrow and the target. What's the next one? Anyone know? Have you heard? What order? Let's see. Yeah, then compassion. Second one, compassion. Third one, guru. Meditation guru, on the guru. And the fourth one, wisdom. Okay, so let's go through this. What does the first one mean? So when you're involved in anger, and remember we said, vigilant of my mind stream through all actions, like in the 8 verses, when afflictions arise, endangering myself and others. If you're vigilant, you're recognizing, occasionally you're watching your mind say, oh my gosh, I'm getting angry. I have to confront this. That means, stop right now and apply the antidote. Avert it with the antidote. Avert means, you know what avert means? Like you keep something, you chase it away. How can you do that? where you apply either the ultimate antidote of wisdom of emptiness, but probably the temporal antidotes. So the first one is the target, the arrow and the target. What that means is this. There is no way that we can experience something unpleasant that's going to give rise to your anger unless you created the cause in the past, right? Is that true? There's no way that you can... We know from karma. Basically, this first one is to recognize that this situation hasn't arisen because of the other person only. This is actually your fault. Somehow in the past, you'd created the karma. You shot the arrow. You created the karma. It's been going through time. And now when the right conditions arise, like the target is there, someone has said some bad words to you, that karma can ripen, that arrow can hit the target. So it's actually, so in doing so, it's very, very skillful, because in thinking this way, it first diffuses the your anger, because your thought was, I've got to be vigilant in my mind. This is, I shouldn't be getting angry. I'm going to apply the antidote. You take your attention away from the instigating factor that you're exaggerating. You know, that this person is the total source of my problem. And you're thinking of the opposite. Actually, I'm the one who created this problem by creating the karma in the past. Wow, if you ever try that, you keep that as amongst these four antidotes in your arsenal. Remember that you're going to be, that verse that says, vigilant in my mind stream, throughout all actions. When delusions arise, when afflictions arise, endangering myself and others, such as anger, I will confront and avert them without delay. You want to confront them with these antidotes and avert them, cause them to either diminish with a temporal antidote, which is probably all we can do now, or eventually eliminate them with wisdom of emptiness. So if you apply this in the various ways of thinking about this too, that you keep on thinking, and in so doing, the anger in your mind begins to disappear. It's not going to be manifest. Later, if you forget this antidote and you remember that incident, you might get angry again. That's why it's called the temporal antidote. While the antidote is there, temporarily, the anger is subdued. Okay? It's not an ultimate antidote. So you can think, actually, this other, I can elaborate more on that next time, because we've just got a few minutes to go through these four. So the next one is compassion. And you can think, one part of the mind, one superimposition of the mind was sort of superimposing on the person that they are the main cause of the anger that can instigate the anger. So thinking that this is my fault, I created the karma in the past, the karma, the target and the arrow, that can get rid of that superimposition, that wrong projection of the mind, that they're the main cause. Then another kind of thing that can instigate is that they are worthy to be beaten. Have you ever heard the expression when someone says some harsh words and you say, oh, you shouldn't have said that to that person, and they say, you might say, no, they needed that. Have you ever heard that? Oh, they deserve that. Don't tell me I shouldn't have said those bad words, you know. Because that's part of the dynamic. You know, there are different factors that can arise. Some of them, sometimes all of these factors can be present to cause the anger to be very strong. Sometimes just one will be prominent. One is this, I think, especially if you think of the person as someone that you don't respect. You know, it's easy to have that they deserve, like the famous plantations where they owned the slaves and they considered them inferior, and they easy if they had did anything to offend you, you would beat them. They deserve for that, you know. Whereas compassion is a mind that thinks exactly the opposite. They deserve to be taken care of. Just like me, they want to be happy. They want to be free of suffering. Think of the number of times I've made mistakes. I've said harsh words, then done damaging things. I would like to be forgiven. Sometimes I was abused, but there are kinds. Maybe you have a kind aunt. You've gone to her house and you spilled some cherry soda, you know, the red soda, on her very precious carpet, leaving a stain that's going to be maybe impossible or very difficult to. But if she's very, very kind, she said, "Oh, don't worry." Has that ever happened? Something like that ever happened? You've done something really bad, but the person who was the recipient of your bad action, they had very good heart, and they said, "Oh, don't. Doesn't matter. Maybe you've broken something." Does that? If you've ever had an experience of that, bring that to mind. Think, just as I would love to be, even if I've done something wrong, and I've done over numberless lives, I've done myriad, billions, trillions, innumerable, infinite numbers of negative things. But I would always like to think, "Oh no, that's okay, George, you know. It's okay, don't worry about it." Wouldn't we feel good? That's how we should think of the other person. But why? They've been our mother numberless times in the past. We don't recognize that. If our present mother were to be, had been hospitalized, maybe she was losing her memory, and you lost contact with her for a long period of time, and then she comes to your door. Someone, maybe the hospital people, bring her to the door. She doesn't know, and she comes in and she starts yelling at you. You recognize her. If you recognize, at first you don't know who it is, some crazy lady, and then you say, "Mom?" At that point, what happens to your anger? It disappears, because you recognize this is your mother acting crazy. Instead of being angry at her, you have compassion for her. Does it make sense? Okay, so arrow in the target in the arrow, compassion. And the third one, another way we can superimpose that can incite our anger, fuel our anger, is to think, this situation I don't need. In fact, there's a kind of expression I noticed colloquially in America that, "I don't need this." Like someone, your boyfriend is giving you a trouble, you know, arguing with you, and you're ready to dismiss him anyway, and you say, "I don't need this," and you just walk away. Does that sound familiar? That kind of expression? The frame of mind that thinks, this unpleasant situation, hearing harsh words or being beaten or being deprived of happiness, someone leaving you that you thought you could rely on, your mind wants to think, this situation has nothing for me, nothing beneficial for me. This is only a problem. I don't need this. So the antidote to that is to think, this situation, this person or the situation is my guru. Well, how is that? How does a guru, what's the function of the guru? To lead you to higher realizations. The function of the guru is not to coddle you, you know, to take your face in his hand or her hand. "Oh, you're so perfect. I love you." And sometimes a guru is like that at the beginning. But the real gurus, when you've developed some familiarity and confidence and faith in them, they can cut right through to your ego. They can say, you know, right in front of everyone else, your faults, you know, and confront you to, cause you to confront your own ego. Here, the guru is acting in a way to help you to practice patience. As anger is the greatest, the most destructive affliction, with respect, in that sense, patience is the greatest virtue. Because patience is what allows you to not get angry. So the guru, you're this person, maybe they don't, you might say, how could you say to your guru, they didn't intend for me to practice patience? You know? How could you say that? But they don't have to intend for them to be kind and to function as a guru. They don't have to have the intention of helping you. Like we talk about the kindness of the Dharma. The Dharma is just realizations. Dharma, you know, you could talk about a person who teaches the Dharma, who possesses Dharma in their continuum as being kind to us. But generally, Dharma is an inanimate thing. But we talk about the kindness of the Dharma. Also, when we talk about bodhicitta, we talk about not only the kindness of mother, we talk about the kindness of friends, the kindness of strangers, and then, more difficult to understand, the kindness of the enemy, because they give us the opportunity to practice patience. They're our guru. So instead of thinking, this situation I don't need this. I said, I need this because this irritating situation is giving me the opportunity to practice patience. Can you practice patience with your loving dog? Okay, maybe it makes poo-poo on your bed or something like that, pee-pee here or that, you might have to practice patience. Or someone who loves you, always agrees with you. There's no object, there's no way to practice patience with respect to them. You can only practice patience with respect to something that's irritating, maybe that strongly causes you anger. You know, there's another one of the verses of the 8 verses that says, when I encounter beings of bad character, gripped by strong suffering and negative actions, you know, like bad, nasty people doing bad things, harming you, I will practice to see them as a precious treasure difficult to acquire. And when someone I have benefited and whom I have great hopes gives me unjust harm, I will practice to see them as my holy guru. So those two verses are related to this. So when someone is harming you unjustly, to see them as your guru, especially if they're gripped by suffering and so forth and under the influence of delusions. So you can apply compassion into that also. So next time I'm going to talk about the fourth antidote, and then we'll go back to talking about the virtuous mental factors and the rest of these delusions. We've run out of time today. The fourth antidote is the arrow and the target? What? Compassion, guru, wisdom. So wisdom has two aspects. One is a wisdom of impermanence. Just to realize that this will pass. That sometimes, that can get rid of the anger. But the main purpose, and when Geshe Changwa talked about these four, he's mainly talking about ultimate wisdom of emptiness. So we'll talk about how that can apply as an antidote. So practice that between now and next Tuesday, if you're going to come back. See if you can apply these first three antidotes if some irritating situation comes up. You know? If I didn't create the karma for this, there'd be no way for this to happen. It's not that person's fault. You know, I'm responsible. Your own, not only you create positive state of mind, creating virtuous karma, you diffuse and stop creating negative karma. Think of compassion. Think of the person as giving you the opportunity of practicing patience. So if you have a question, I remember you'd raised your hand. I'll just dedicate now if you want to come up, and I'll stay for a couple of minutes afterwards or as long as necessary to answer questions. So let's just finish up. We try to have a good motivation at the beginning, which gave the general outline, the impetus, the inertia of this action of listening to the teachings, participating, you know, analyzing, contemplating. So we created virtuous karma, and to take that, imagine that karma and all the karma, virtuous karma we've created in the past, You can even dedicate the merits of other people. All the merits that Lama Zopa has created, that Geshe Trunia has created, that the Dalai Lama has created, all of my Dharma brothers and sisters at ABC, all of the karma, that virtuous karma, that I have created in the past, the present, especially this session, in whatever way it ripens, may it bring about the eventual realization of enlightenment in my own and in the continua of other beings, so that myself and others can effortlessly and spontaneously alleviate the suffering of sentient beings. Due to these merits, may I quickly become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. And you could do as we did at the beginning, with the remembering the clarity of your mind, so that thought of dedicating them these merits, that may they ripen in that way. Imagine that very strong conviction or wish or desire, dedication, sort of the fade into the clarity of your mind. Seal it that way, and then let it reemerge from the clarity of your mind, that conviction, just imputed, dedication, just imputed, imputedly existent, not inherently existent. Thank you very much.